feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for a thousand years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA. War this way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the red. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. We have tropical storm warnings here in Fort Lauderdale, so if I disappear, you'll know that the phone or power line went down. I'm certainly hoping to be here for the whole show, though. More on that later. I was chatting with a friend from Sweden earlier today. She loves horses. She does some riding, dressage and all that. Not competitively, but she's good at it. She often watches the national competitions, and today it turns out one of Sweden's top riders is set to lose her horse within a few days. Somebody started up a fund with a campaign on Facebook trying to buy the horse that this lady's been riding, and so that she can ride it in the next Olympics. The result has been awesome. It's going viral. The Swedes and others are ponying up their cash to help out. Great outpouring of sympathy and support for somebody who's been a symbol for their country. Not clear if they'll actually make the goal. I'm guessing they will. You know, I don't know what to make of this. On the one hand, I love to see people banding together to change something, anything. People supporting each other, well, that's something, that's one of the themes, one of the goals for this radio show. And I love horses. I'm glad to see somebody so devoted to keeping such a fine animal. But I can't help thinking all that money could be spent to help people in need, might be a better cause. Things that we choose to support with crowdsourced funds are often a bit mysterious. Another friend, one from California, been working directly on a fundraising project, something about building Christian schools in the Middle East. I suppose that's a more worthy cause, at least the idea of providing a place for children, some place they can learn and have some measure of safety in the midst of a region that's ravaged by war and upheaval. Seems like a good idea. I'm a Christian myself, you know. Spreading the word about the Prince of Peace seems like a good idea too, but then I wonder, this kind of a project, isn't that a slap in the face of to the Muslim majority? Isn't it an act of war more than an act of peace? A deliberate target, perhaps, created for later destruction as a means of justifying escalation towards World War III. Perhaps I'm getting paranoid, seeing evil corporate conspiracies everywhere I look. But, you know, they say that just because you're paranoid, that doesn't mean that there isn't anything after you, that the things that you fear aren't real. It's the lying and deceit of our so-called leaders that has led me to feel like this. I like to trust people and give them the benefit of the doubt. It's increasingly hard to do that on a national level. It's increasingly hard to do that with governments, especially our own. I started out tonight talking about Tropical Storm Sandy. I can hear the winds outside, the rain. Not really that much worse than any other storm this time of year. But there's something a little different about tropical storms. Where your typical thunderstorm, it's more or less a random in its strength. It wanes or gains in fury with little pattern. A tropical storm has a very definite ebb and flow, almost having a musical rhythm to it. I actually rather enjoy listening to it, as long as it doesn't knock out the power or the internet or the phone. This particular storm's named Sandy, and that concerns me a bit. We had a dog named Sandy. He was a very loving dog, but she was fiercely protective. We ended up having to get rid of her. The whole neighborhood rose up to tell us we either had to move or get rid of our dogs. She'll remember giving her a last hug when we turned her over to the animal shelter. I couldn't stop sobbing back then, so I guess I'd better not think about it too much now. I think I've rambled on enough tonight. I'd like to turn the show over to my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we're going to welcome special guests Doug Dream and Mickey Z. Doug and Mickey have both been with us before. Doug is in Western Oregon and Mickey Z is in New York City. And so tonight we are gathering together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Western Oregon, New York City, and wherever you are. A couple articles I want to note. These are both on Veterans Today. Kevin Barrett, this one is titled Election Fraud, Storm Clouds Loom Over Presidential Race. Election Fraud, Storm Clouds Loom Over Presidential Race. The second one is Gordon Duff. It's titled Ashamed, Living in Post-Rational America. Gordon Duff and Kevin Barrett on Veterans Today. Well, now I'm going to take some time to try to convince you not to vote in the coming presidential election. You are walking around in your backyard, hands behind your back, head down, walking in circles around and around. You remember all that Obama has done, but all they have to do to get him back in, regardless, to make Obama look like the good guy, is to run a crazy guy against him. You know you cannot vote for Mitt Romney. Walking, walking. You don't like Obama, but you don't want Romney. And so, well, but you can also not cast your vote to encourage drone murders, the war in Afghanistan. You cannot vote to encourage the man who said we must believe that 19 young men did the 9/11 attacks, and either through a real serious lack of intellectual curiosity or criminal involvement, refused to investigate the previous administration for collusion in the attacks. And Obama gave us a watered-down, drowned version of health care when what this country needs is universal health care. Everyone knows that. He lied right to our faces about Osama bin Laden being buried at sea. He is not for hope and change. He is for himself and his rich friends. You see that now clearly. He is a fake. His first job out of college was with the CIA. His mother and father had CIA connections. Well, so did the Bushes, you tell yourself, and probably Clinton and Nixon and Reagan and all of them. They probably all were run by some alphabet agency or bank or something. If they are not, they don't get very far. That's just the way it is. At least he's not a Republican. And yet, how in hell do you go into that little box or behind that short curtain carrying your 7th grade American civics textbook and your Bible and waste your own one little measly pencil mark on that? And so, you decide instead to vote for the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, because she is a real Democrat, what a Democrat should be. She is heroic and for the underdog, the worker, the oppressed. Democrats are supposed to even out the playing field, give us hope in a just, lasting world, in the real ideal of America, and make us feel a little better that everything will eventually be okay, or at least not terrible. You go to her website and see that she is for cutting the military budget just like you are. Her points include maintain and upgrade our nation's essential public infrastructure. Provide tuition-free education, kindergarten through college. Wow. You look for your pencil. Somebody tells you they will have pencils at the voting place thing. You say, okay, good. Provide complete, affordable, quality health care for every American. You almost poop when you read that and you check yourself. Still good to go. An immediate moratorium on foreclosures and evictions. Somebody had better keep this woman out of Memphis, Dallas, the North Woods, and the Ambassador Hotel, you think to yourself. End mountaintop removal in Appalachia. Phase out nuclear power. Phase out coal power plants. Repeal the Patriot Act. Repeal the National Defense Authorization Act. Oppose the Online Piracy Act, pass the Equal Rights Amendment, implement marriage equality nationwide, abolish the Electoral College, require the use of auditable, hand-counted paper ballots, cut Pentagon spending by 50%, demilitarize U.S. foreign policy to emphasize human rights, ban the use of drone aircraft for assassination, bombing, and other offensive purposes. End the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Close some 140 U.S. military bases overseas. Initiate a new round of nuclear disarmament initiatives. At this point, you pee and you let it be. It's all good. Create millions of green jobs such as weatherization, recycling, public transportation, worker and community-owned cooperatives, and energy-efficient infrastructure. Demilitarize border crossings throughout North America. End the war on immigrants. Repair our communities rather than dump resources into the prison industrial complex. Legalize medical use of marijuana and move to permit general legal sales under suitable regulatory framework. End the war on drugs and begin to treat drug use as a public health problem, not a criminal problem. And by this time, you have asked someone to run down to Big Foods for refreshments for the big election, changing this damn country, finally party later. And you are already driving and texting, telling your friends you are headed to the polling place thing to vote for Jill Stein. You have found a real candidate, someone and something to be excited about. You are ecstatic to find that America still exists. You are not the only one who feels this way about these things. You smoke 9 cigarettes. Your car catches fire. You dive out the window onto the sidewalk, letting the car burn. You dash into the polling place thing, patting yourself to put out the smoldering ashes in your hair and in your clothes. You vote for Jill Stein. You go home to watch the TV and stay up until 4 a.m. before anyone mentions the name Jill Stein. You think about that, and by 7 a.m., you decide that the one-sentence mention of Jill Stein at 4 a.m. was already decided long ago, months ago. You remember that they stole the elections in 2000 and 2004. You recall that they would not let Jill Stein into the real presidential debates. None of the big-time TV political reporters who live in big houses with big dogs and big families and big lives, who spend their whole big days thinking and reading about politics and issues and what is best for this country, seem to even know she had been born. But why not, you ask yourself? She has great ideas. And you realize at 8 a.m., that you running up to the polling place station thing with your hair on fire like it mattered was also a part of the plan, to make it look like it all mattered, that it was a real election. By 8:37 a.m., you have downed your third Bud Light Summer Lime, fall sale, $9.99, and by 9 a.m., you are asleep on your sofa. You wake up at 2 p.m. and realize it was all a dream, a recurring dream you have had off and on throughout your life. The names and faces pound in your aching head as you reach blindly under the cushion for that yellow lighter. Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Clinton, Bush, it's all a dream, the American dream. And you find that white pad from Hotel 6 and a pencil, the one you stole from the voting polling place station thing as a remembrance for the big night, and you write, "Never again. I swear I will never do this again." You put the note on the refrigerator door with the magnet from the Legion Club. And you go back and sit on the sofa to smoke and stare out the front window. The neighborhood kids on their bikes jumping that broken ridge in your sidewalk. And out at the wilted city park with the cannon in the middle and the stolid line of stone eagles who have not moved, changed for 40, 50, 60 years, staring down at the cannonballs beside the cannon like they were perfect drops of golden poop, and they were protecting them. American golden poop balls. Giant milk duds that do not melt in your mouth, but they sit big and hard in your stomach, rolling around, throwing you off balance forever. And you realize that next time you will not vote. You may never vote again for President of the United States. You are just letting them use you by being part of their corrupted, orchestrated, choreographed play. And they are laughing at you right now with your election hangover, your busted-up sidewalk, and your broken dream. Never, never again, not until something changes. Nope. What you want is a new dream. This old one is for the birds. Okay, back to you, Chuck.
America will soon end, and nature will live, have the last word. Nature bats last, as the saying goes. Some famous last words. Christine Todd Whitman, head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Oh, the air is safe to breathe. Colin Powell at the UN. My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
Ronald Reagan, approximately 80% of our air pollution stems from hydrocarbons released by vegetation. So let's not go overboard in setting and enforcing tough emission standards for man-made sources. George W. Bush, the same folks that are bombing innocent people in Iraq were the ones who attacked us in America on September the 11th. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, speaking about the millions of deaths caused in Iraq by the sanctions during the Clinton administration, we think it's worth it. Barack Obama, Osama bin Laden has been buried at sea. And now please join us for another episode of Beltway Sandy Van Snore, Big Time American Journalism Whore. Sandy had been busy lately as usual, and he was just relaxing on Saturday, walking with his wife, kids, and dogs in Georgetown along the canal towpath where Mary Meyer was murdered in 1964 by the CIA to keep her from telling about the truth, about the JFK assassination thing. Sandy wasn't with the company way back then, but he knows people who were. He doesn't ask them about it. They don't mention it. He was in the stands for the national games, the game, a couple of weeks ago. Nationals against the Cardinals, the debacle in the ninth against the Cardinals. He texted his kids from the third row behind home plate, and they waved back to him. They're just kids. And Sandy Van Snor was also in Hempstead, New York, at Hofstra, covering the second presidential debate. He flew into JFK and then rented a car with a few others and drove the half hour there.
Mary Meyer, JFK Airport, presidential debates. Connections all kind of run together when you're on the run, trying to put together a career and family. Sandy Van Snor jogs on the canal towpath. His feet strike the pavement probably twice a week, right where Mary Meyer's head hit after being shot with a handgun at close range. At the debate, it was all very exciting if one stops himself for a moment to realize that, well, doesn't let it all just be something expected. Whole life will be like this, front row seats. Sandy and his journalism chums park their car, walk past the public free speech zone by Hagedorn Hall, on their way to the Max Sports and Exhibition Complex. Their credentials and refreshments and seats were waiting for the international event, the second Obama-Romney debate.
As they passed by, walking fast, they turned their heads to check out the size of the crowd and heard the speaker on the platform, seemingly very passionate about something. Someone hustling along on Sandy's right pointed, and they all headed for the big building and the crowds and the bright lights. They got their laminated clip-on tags and talked to others, then found their seats and watched. Then afterwards, they went to the media hall and stayed until they had to leave, visited for a while on the short, crowded drive back to JFK. Then the processing through the airport, the plane, the short ride back to town, the quick, tired goodbyes, and walk to the parking lot.
Sandy waved to the black parking attendant in the little box on his way out and was greeted in turn by name, Mr. Van Snor. He tuned the radio to sports talk on the freeway. Listen to some more fans complain about Steve Strasburg and how that all went down. Sandy Van Snor turned onto his street and saw some lights still on, pulled into his drive, turned off his car, wondered if it would just be okay right here for an hour if he needed to bring it inside the garage. He sat there. His story was already in, being dealt with by a night editor he'd not met yet. Tomorrow, he needed to be in sometime before noon. He wasn't thinking about that. He reached blindly to the seat next to him for a pen and pad. There's the pen, the pad. The pad has got to be here. I want to forget this. This is something I finally have to do. Tomorrow's the day to finally do it. Sandy wrote in the dark, writing big because he could not see, to remind himself to check the Nationals website to see if season tickets for 2013 were on sale yet. Tune in next week for another edition of Beltway Sandy Snor, Big Time American Journalism Horror.
Now I'd like to welcome our first guest, Doug Dream. Doug is a poet and short story writer and playwright. He's been writing and publishing in the underground small press since the late 1960s. His poems and short stories have appeared in hundreds of print and online journals. Doug currently lives in Oregon with his wife, writer Carol Shepherd Drain. Doug's latest book is More Than the Alley, and I hear that Doug is there. Hello, Doug.
Hi. How's it going, Mike?
Good. How are you tonight?
I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good so far. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. What do you have? You have the new book, More Than the Alley. Can you tell us about that and how it's doing?
Well, I guess it's selling pretty good. I haven't really heard from my publisher for a while, so I don't really know. But it's gotten some pretty good reviews, and I got a sense that it's doing pretty good, but I'm not really sure. And the book is basically just a collection of poems that I've written, probably since around 1975, something like that. And I understand that it's doing pretty good, so hopefully I'm right.
Well, I hope it is too. Do you have something from that book or from other poems or whatever you'd like to do to read for us tonight?
Okay, yeah, I have. I was going to read from the book. I tried to pick poems today, but got sidetracked, so I decided just to read from the book, if that's all right.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, want me to just go?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, the first one is called Walking on Water. I walked into the Wabash River, up to my waist, fully clothed, drunk out of my mind at 16. I thought for a moment there that I could really walk on water. My friends on the bank of the sandbar screaming at me to get my ass out, that someone had called the cops. But 12 bottles of Miller High Life and a half pint of Jim Beam had sent me on a mission, sent me over the wobbling edge into some kind of insane spiritual probing of elated intoxication and power and uncontrolled fits of laughter. On the bank, Kenny threw a rock that hit the water just to the left of me. Then Vic threw an empty beer bottle that I had to duck to avoid from smashing into my head. And as I laughed, I laughed and laughed and laughed. I have yet to see the moon and stars quite as beautiful and mind-blowing as they were on that night. And I looked up and laughed hysterically at them too, just before the cops got there. And I made them walk into the water to get me. I laughed and prophesied their doom all the way to the county lockup. But the view of the night sky from the barred jail cell window wasn't quite the same. Okay, let's see here. Next one is called Disneyland. And it starts, Mickey Mouse sold out in 1939 when he pawned his tugboat to Hitler to pull cargo ships full of dead bodies stuffed inside thousands of Volkswagens like marinating sardines. They say Walt is frozen somewhere. I most respectfully suggest someone sneak in and place a good-sized space heater next to him in his ice tomb to keep him dead. He's done enough for the world. Okay, the next one is called The Suits Won't Go Away. And I may have read this on your show before, but I'm not really certain. I lost all my notes to that. But it's called The Suits Won't Go Away. I've seen these suits with dead faces since I was a kid. I remember closing my eyes tight after looking at an insurance salesman or a preacher. How do you tell the difference? And praying he would not be there when I opened them. I still do it at times with CEOs in their designer suits and generals in battle dress with death arrayed in ribbons across their breast. I still shut my eyes tight at morticians and talk show hosts and lying politicians with a hint of color in their porky pig neckties. Not to say, though, that all men who wear suits are on my shit list. Like Camus looked fantastic in a suit. Presley wore suits with an unmistakable cool. Miles and Coltrane and Kenneth Patchen wore suits. And Einstein wore a black rumpled suit with impeccable class. I admire men like that who happen to have worn suits. Men who have something to sell other than war, mind control, and spiritual stagnation. I know the suits will not go away, no matter how long I close my eyes and pray. It's been the same since the white race rose to power. The Huns wore suits, and down the line, Hitler, that many of them imitate him, wearing his suit of death, perfect fit. There's no tailoring needed. And let's see. The next one is called Old Homeless Man in the St. Francis Hotel. It's a rather short one. I see it was all he could do to keep from crying, and I kept expecting his lower lip to begin trembling and sobs to shake his bent body. But he was dignified, holding himself erect as he talked to the nightly news, cursing and raving at the television set over the war. Okay, let's see. The next one I have is called The Poem. I know I have succeeded in this because I have failed at everything else. Just ask my ex-wife. Ask any phony poet of flowers and cheap reflections. They will tell you I have failed miserably at life and poetry. Ask my teachers. Ask my employers. Ask the cops. Ask the IRS. Go ahead. Ask the U.S. Army. Request my file from the FBI. Question the would-be assassins of my soul. They will be in agreement. They will be nodding their heads like retarded sheep. Okay. The next one is called Sometimes, or rather long one. I don't know how my time is going here. This would probably take about, two or three minutes anyway. It's called Sometimes. Sometimes it points to the sky of blue, pointing like a bird dog. Sometimes it buries itself deep in the nothingness of political thinking. Sometimes it screams through the black, black lies once told by you and I. Sometimes it just sits there like J. Edgar Hoover with a cheap tape recorder plotting your death. Sometimes it spends years adding up numbers in an attempt to round off infinity. Sometimes it hides in the couch with change from hundreds of pockets. Sometimes it burns and burns the trees we can't see the forest for. Sometimes it runs like an out of control, a driverless locomotive down a steep mountain pass. Sometimes it stands trendy poets up against the wall of timeless literature and shoots them. Sometimes it lances boils on the butts of opossums. Sometimes it checks into motels under the names of Curly, Moe, and Larry. Sometimes it loves beauty for the right reasons. Sometimes it can name every painting in the Chicago Art Museum blindfolded. Sometimes it is impossible to decode with extrasensory perception or any kind of perception. Sometimes it breaks your heart. Sometimes it plans wars on planets and distant galaxies. Sometimes it whittles exquisite little angels out of cherry wood. Sometimes it stands on its head and imitates Erica Jung. Sometimes it captures butterflies and sets them free in the Pope's bedroom. Sometimes it goes into tirades over the absurdity of collective consciousness. Sometimes it teaches law students at Harvard how to make tiny gas chambers. Sometimes it stumbles around in Dante's Inferno, selling copies of Milton's Paradise Lost. Sometimes it poses like P.T. Barnum, standing behind a billboard, trying to explain the difference between propaganda and advertising. Sometimes it wishes on a star. Sometimes it pretends to be a tugboat on the Mississippi in 1859. Sometimes it's a relief. Sometimes it surfaces in London, claiming it never knew the gun was loaded. Sometimes it whirls like a ballet dancer in the middle of a completely empty Times Square. Sometimes it simply is not there, regardless of what blind faith may say. Sometimes it counts all the hairs on your head and then splits them. Sometimes it can be caught adjusting the color control on the telescope at the Griffith Observatory. Sometimes it peters out before you do. Sometimes it hits solar activity to disrupt TV transmissions. Sometimes it resembles a dove flying above. Sometimes it shoots out streetlights. Sometimes it never stands in a certain place overlooking the Hudson River. Sometimes it has no remorse. Sometimes it shines. Sometimes it rolls around in history. Sometimes it's as lonely as a grave. Sometimes it skydives in the Grand Canyon. Sometimes it can be heard giving a testimony on true love at the Taj Mahal. Sometimes it takes pictures of fat men eating. Sometimes it fastens itself on the back of poor judgment. Sometimes it holds the truths that are self-evident. Sometimes it wanders around in the wilderness for 40 years, missing the way out repeatedly. Sometimes it's out of focus. Sometimes it has no reason for being. Sometimes it foams at the mouth, then spits up into oblivion. Sometimes it hammers invisible nails into smog. Sometimes it simply is. Sometimes it sets a course for Easter Island. Sometimes it walks the floors at Graceland. Sometimes it has a way of fooling the wisest of men. Sometimes it leaks information to expired newspapers. Sometimes it has no way of coping. Sometimes it circles the covered wagons. Sometimes it knows no limits. Sometimes it climbs mountains dressed in a tuxedo. Sometimes it is released from bondage. Sometimes it is functional for a few minutes. Sometimes it divides nations. Sometimes it shimmers on the moonlit water. Sometimes it runs a race with stolen shoes. Sometimes it pauses for applause. Sometimes it deals cards from the bottom of the deck. Sometimes it alters events for diabolical purposes. Sometimes it is your friend. Sometimes it jumps like a jackrabbit into the red moon. Sometimes it moves around the bases like a 90-year-old Babe Ruth. And that's it.
Doug, thank you very much. And I think we're going to have to wrap it up there. Could you tell folks again the name of the book and where they would go to find the book?
Okay. It's called More Than the Alley. It's published by Interior Noise Press, and that's www.interiornoisepress.com. It can also be bought or purchased at Amazon.com and also Barnes & Noble.
Thank you very much, Doug, and thank you for your work, and thanks for being on the show again, and I hope we'll be able to talk to you again in a couple months.
I hope so. Well, thank you for having me again. You take care.
You bet. See you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
America will soon end, and nature will live, have the last word. Nature bats last, as the saying goes. Some more famous last words. Gene Kirkpatrick, member of Ronald Reagan's cabinet, on the kidnapping, rape, and murder of American nuns in El Salvador. The nuns were not just nuns. The nuns were political activists. Apollo 11 astronauts at a press conference 3 weeks after they were supposed to have been on the moon. Neil Armstrong, we were never able to see stars without looking through the optics. Michael Collins, I don't remember seeing any. Neil Armstrong's speech at 25th anniversary of Apollo 11. There are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of the truth's protective layers.
Janet Reno on the burning children alive at Waco. Our concern was for the children. Ronald Reagan, what we have found in this country, and maybe we're more aware of it now, is one problem that we've had, even in the best of times, and that is the people who are sleeping on the grates, the homeless who are homeless, you might say, by choice.
Barack Obama. I'm aware that some would question the events of 9/11, but let us be clear. Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 people that day. Larry Silverstein. We've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
FDR on Pearl Harbor. This is a day that will live in infamy. The McCollum memo, also known as the eight-point action memo, suggested that the United States provoke Japan into committing an overt act of war. The memo illustrates several people in the Office of Naval Intelligence promoted the idea of goading Japan into war. It is not believed that in the present state of political opinion, the United States government is capable of declaring war against Japan without more ado. If by the 8-point plan, Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better.
Our second guest tonight is Mickey Z. Michael Zazima, better known as Mickey Z, born April 30, 1960, is a writer, editor, blogger, and novelist living in New York City. He writes bi-monthly column. He's a regular contributor to World News Trust, Planet Green, ZNet, Counterpunch, many other websites. And most recently, he's been spending a lot of time with the Occupy movement.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show, Mickey Z.
Thanks, Jeff. It's always a pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
Well, we love to have you on. I'd like you to go over for the listeners a little bit about who you are and what you've been doing.
Well, I've been a writer for many years, and currently you could find my work most often on World News Trust website, but I've written 11 books. I've been on a lot of different radical and political websites. And more recently, I've been engaging in a lot of photography, and that has been a big part of my on-the-ground reporting here with Occupy Wall Street for the past year. And a big focus of my writing and my photography work for the past year has been this movement and how it's played out and influenced and changed the conversation. And folks can find me online, just Google Mickey Z or look me up on Facebook, Mickey Z-Vegan, and I also have a blog, MickeyZ.net.
Well, tell us a little more about this this on-the-ground reporting at the Occupy movement.
Well, it's a combination of reporting and participating. I would say when the movement first began last September, I was skeptical. Based on many years of taking part and witnessing activism as something that usually is single issue and very rarely lasts more than a day. But after about a week of hearing about Occupy Wall Street, I got down to Zuccotti Park / Liberty Square, and what I saw was unlike anything else I'd ever seen before in my activist experience. It was, the difference was palpable, and there was a holistic approach. All issues were being considered and welcomed. And basically what I felt like, what I saw was the beginning of a modeling of an alternative form of human culture. And I enthusiastically jumped on board and have been involved in one way or another for the past year, whether it's taking part in the actions, giving talks, taking photos, and writing lots of articles. And it's been a real highlight in my personal life in the past year. And I think it's been a crucial change in the way activism takes place here in the United States and influenced elsewhere.
But of course, most of us don't get to hear that much about it. The corporate media acts as if it's not really happening anymore.
Yeah, I mean, they started by ignoring it, and then when high-profile events like the pepper spraying and the multiple arrests on the Brooklyn Bridge occurred, they turned it sort of into a spectacle. And then after the eviction last November, they basically returned to the blackout mode, where they'd occasionally report a negative story about Occupy, but in classic corporate media style, they just pretend it's not happening and distract us with other stories. But with the continuing growth of social media and the internet and on-the-ground reporting, the people I'm surrounded with there are amazing, and live streaming and so on. the stories are getting out there. The alternative perspectives are getting out there, not as much as we'd like it to be, but I think the challenge to the corporate media is clear. It's happening, and Occupy Wall Street isn't going away. And I've taken on as my own personal mission, wherever I could reach, to document what I'm involved in, to let people know what's happening here on the ground.
Well, that's a very good thing to do, and I hope you'll keep it up.
I definitely plan on it.
I'd like to talk a little bit about this so-called election that's coming up.
Yep.
It's crazy that we have two people we don't like that are the only ones that are supposed to have any chance at all. We have the candidate for both president and vice president of the Green Party managed to get arrested just trying to participate in debates. This country is going crazy.
Well, it's not as if the elections were ever particularly open, but they get more narrow every cycle. And to think now that the candidates are raising towards $1 billion each, that should set off alarms in homes all across America. I don't know how people aren't on the streets in outrage to think that the only people who have even a chance of being part of a debate have to raise $1 billion. But and then we can go into the electoral college system and so on. There's so many levels of deception and fraud, but the story you brought up is really indicative of the state we've reached, where a woman by the name of Jill Stein, who's the Green Party presidential candidate, can be arrested for trying to attend the presidential debate last week at Hofstra University on Long Island. And not only was she arrested, she was shackled to a chair for about 12 hours, but it was virtually not covered by the media. And I was joking with someone just yesterday that when I try to tell people about this, their first response would be, wait, there is a Green Party candidate? Or they voice astonishment that a woman is actually running for president. Before we could even focus on the fact that the arrest took place, I realized how out in quote-unquote mainstream America, people aren't even aware that Jill Stein is alive, never mind running. And it's important to recognize that, because within the circles, like if I'm moving around in activist circles and Occupy circles, of course they know who she is, and the conversations tend to center around a better grip of reality. But the more frightening reality is that a big chunk of Americans get the bulk of their news from the corporate media, and this is setting an agenda that is heading us in a direction that doesn't work for anyone, not even the 1%. And so every 4 years, the insanity gets to a peak level with the elections. It's a major distraction. It turns into a major spectacle. And unfortunately, it negatively impacts, in many cases, on-the-ground activism, where people get distracted by the election and don't do the direct actions and the dirty work that needs to be done to make the changes that we have no choice to make, but to make.
Well, how can people actually make those changes?
Well, I believe a crucial turning point, which I don't know, I mean, we're getting pretty close here. I don't know what happened in 2012, perhaps better than 2008, would be to recognize that change isn't going to come from the top down, and it never has. There's no evidence to demonstrate that to be true. And if we could just look at the presidential elections as what they are, just changing the figurehead or not changing the figurehead of American empire, and realize that if you decide to vote, it's an hour or two on a random Tuesday, but the real hard work has to be educating yourself, reaching out to communities, finding out what issues are relevant to those communities, making the connections, creating solidarity, and coming up with creative and sustainable ways to participate in direct action to challenge the 1%, at the same time growing the movement. And it's easier said than done, of course, but we are in a state right now where we don't have time on our side. There are urgent and serious crises happening right now, and it's very, very frustrating to see so much attention being paid to a presidential election while the environment is under assault and human rights are under assault, animal rights are under assault. I could go on for hours describing what's happening. And here we are analyzing the facial expression of two very rich men running for president in a debate that doesn't even allow the other candidates to participate.
It is definitely a sad state of affairs. You know, I'm tempted not to vote at all. Probably the thing that will actually get me to vote is not the presidential election, but some of the more local things. In particular, Florida is attempting to pass four simply horrible amendments that basically will make it very difficult for people who don't have so much money to continue getting the benefits that they're using to live on. And it's not a very good state of affairs. We have a Republican in there, and these are strongly Republican amendments, and they're cleverly disguised so that they sound like they're a great idea.
Yeah. Well, they're geniuses at that. When you read the wording of these referendums, you suddenly can't decide if you should vote yes or no. Like, you know how you feel, but
you're not sure which way matches how you feel.
Yeah, just consider the insanity of even having this conversation in what we believe to be a democracy and the land of the free. That this shouldn't even be an issue. But to get to your point, I can certainly understand and relate to the smaller local issues being such that they can be impacted by elections and voting. The smaller the issue, the more likely that a vote can weigh profoundly. On the larger we go up, when we get to mayors and then governors and senators, congressmen, and of course the president, there's so much money involved. It becomes an entirely different situation. And again, with the presidents, with the electoral college and so on, that I'm very sympathetic to those who choose not to vote. From my perspective, I look at it as a highly corrupt and fraudulent system that, regardless of who wins, will not stop us on this path toward the ecocide. So I personally choose not to participate in this system because I believe so strongly against it. And I think that those who make such a choice, boycotting the elections, are voting in their own way. However, as I said earlier, if people do choose to vote for whatever party they choose to vote, so be it. But let's never, ever forget that it's just 1 hour of your life. And the other 364 plus days should be filled with coming up with other ways to create urgent change. And it's just frustrating every 4 years to see so many smart and passionate and dedicated radical comrades of mine so distracted by the presidential election. And they managed the powers that be managed to do it every 4 years. Every time I get to it, too, and I think, oh, this year is going to be different. This year was a little different, thanks to Occupy, but it still got way more attention than it deserved. And I almost just can't wait till November 7th so we can get back to the serious work and try and preserve the future.
Well, I definitely can't wait because I am sick to death of hearing about it. Every time you turn around, there's a column about it. My wife likes to listen to TV, and I keep hearing all these ads, and you'll hear the one side, you'll hear the other side, and they both sound like they're total idiots, jerks. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, it's a well-orchestrated spectacle to give the illusion of a drastic difference between the two parties. But even when you speak to mainstream Americans, they'll use phrases like lesser evil, where they'll recognize that there's very little, if any, difference between the parties. So they start to nitpick and try to come up with what they perceive as subtle nuances between the two candidates, and that enables them to pick one, but still calling that person the lesser evil. And I've written saying that this syndrome is sort of like a victim of abuse enabling his or her abuser by believing that they can be changed and that we could apologize for them and if we could work with them, as opposed to recognizing that we have a very, very serious problem here and that there is no evidence that this abuser is going to change. In fact, there's no evidence that this abuser won't get seriously worse. And so just as I do every election year, I've written a lot and I've spoken a lot related to trying to reach out to people to challenge this belief that it's such a crucial difference between the two parties and that it will have a huge impact on our lives, when in reality, for the most part, our lives won't be impacted regardless of who wins, because it's the entire system that's corrupt and is responsible for leading us down a very, very dangerous path, a very, very dangerous path for all life on Earth. And we need an awareness of that and more and more solidarity and more methods of challenging that, as opposed to spending so much time focusing on the subtle differences between two Wall Street-funded, ecocide-promoting war criminals.
I'm going to ask you one more question because we're almost out of time.
Okay.
Is there really some way that we can change within this system, or do we have to basically start over like we did in 1776?
I don't know if I would use the phrase start over, but the first part of your question is this: the system we're describing right now, it's a system that's based on relentless exploitation of resources. This constant quest for growth is by definition unsustainable and thus anti-life. And if we maintain any semblance of this system, it may slightly slow things down, but we're heading down the same path. And I think what's crucial for us to remember is that we working from within and subtle reforms, I understand they could impact individuals at the time, but it's a little bit too late. In fact, it's a lot too late to be thinking like that. We need drastic, drastic systemic change, if for no other reason to create a softer place to land. And I think I encourage people to think that big when they're thinking of these issues, while at the same time they're working locally, because nowhere in the mainstream media or culture are we encouraged to look at the big picture, but it's crucial that we do.
Well, those sound like some good words to close on. Let's look at the big picture and let's make it look different.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell people once again where they can find you online, and then we'll have to call it a night.
All right. I write regularly for a website called World News Trust. You can find me on Facebook, Mickey Z-Vegan. My blog is MickeyZ.net, or just type Mickey Z into a search engine and track me down. And I love to interact with people, make new friends, make new comrades, and just continue to grow the movement. So I hope to hear from some people from here.
Well, thank you very much, and have a good night.
Thanks so much, Doug. It's an honor to speak to the audience.
It's an honor to speak with you.
America will soon end, and nature will live, have the last word. Nature bats last, as the saying goes. A few more famous last words. Lyndon Johnson, his midnight address on the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Open aggression on the high seas. Airstrikes are on the way to retaliate. George W. Bush, my fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. That every effort would be made to spare the lives of innocent civilians, but the campaign will be broad and concerted and will use decisive force. No outcome but victory will be accepted. America's freedom will be defended and freedom will be brought to others. George H.W. Bush. Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. Again, George H.W. Bush. My fellow citizens, last night I ordered military forces to Panama. The Warren Commission on the JFK murder. The shots which killed President Kennedy and wounded Governor Connally were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald. J. Robert Oppenheimer upon seeing the first atomic explosion. It worked. On the Wellstone assassination, the National Transportation Safety Board, the likely cause of the accident was the failure of both the pilot and co-pilot to maintain a safe minimum airspeed, leading to a stall from which they could not recover.
It was supposed to be a routine campaign stop. In a poor section of Indianapolis, a largely black crowd had waited an hour to hear the presidential candidate speak. The candidate, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, had been warned not to go by the city's police chief. As his car entered the neighborhood, his police escort left him. Once there, he stood in the back of a flatbed truck. He turned to an aide and asked, "Do they know about Martin Luther King?" They didn't. And it was left to Kennedy to tell them that King had been shot and killed that night in Memphis, Tennessee. The crowd gasped in horror. Kennedy spoke of King's dedication to love and to justice between fellow human beings, adding that he died in the cause of that effort. And Kennedy sought to heal the racial wounds that were certain to follow by referring to the death of his own brother, President John F. Kennedy. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. Many other American cities burned after King was killed. But there was no fire in Indianapolis, which heard the words of Robert Kennedy. An historian says a well-organized black community kept its calm. It's hard to overlook the image of one single man standing on a flatbed truck who never looked down at the paper in his hand, only at the faces in the crowd. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice towards those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black. 2 months later, Robert Kennedy himself was felled by an assassin's bullet.
Nina Rhodes Hughes, who was an eyewitness of the Robert Kennedy murder, standing behind Kennedy in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel, said, "What has to come out is that there was another shooter to my right. The truth has got to be told. No more cover-ups."
If we do not act, if good men and women do nothing, America and the world will soon end. Unless we can find out who's behind the curtain pulling the levers, unless we find the courage, the heart, the brains to journey into that unknown, it will all be over. Because it seems we are not in Kansas anymore.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Joe Coffey, some of the media have taken to calling him Coffey Joe, making fun of him, is on the campaign trail, running for Congress as a Democrat and talking out against war and border fences and prison construction. He and Jane have heard rumblings about the Democratic leadership actually wanting to sabotage his campaign or maybe even him. The Tinkers, Sam, Ray, Herbert, Karen, were meeting at noon, well, as they did every day, in the kitchen of Ray and Karen's place down the road from Herb's house and Sam's down past Attaway's. And now they have gone and done it, pretty much, well, almost. They bought guns and bullets, and now they're having a big meeting in the machine shed, baking pies and hammering together barricades for the revolution.
Karen Tinker sat on the porch steps, lamenting the time on her hands. She rested her arms across her knees and leaned forward, her chin going back and forth across the chair on her arms. She missed the children, crying all the way home the day she took them to town for their first day of real school. Still, she knew they'd be better off there once all this got started. Another pickup waddled onto the yard, parking on the grass. The driver got out, gripped the brim of his cap when he saw Karen, slammed the door shut, looked around at the trucks to see who was there, and stalked toward the metal shed, back straight, thin legs fitting neatly into brown work boots and old blue jeans. The sign on the road said auction, though everyone knew there was no sale. Meetings had been going night and day in the barn, with Sam and Raymond and Herb spreading the word, making speeches, making lists, drawing maps. The Chicago Board of Trade list on the magic marker board inside the glassed office had been replaced by a crude sketch of Smith Farms, with arrows and directions, a warm front line of defense. Why Sheriff McCall didn't drive in here with half a dozen state patrolmen and send these men home, Karen could only imagine. Maybe he really believed this was an auction. Maybe he was too busy getting Dave Vandermeer elected. Or maybe these guys had kept quiet as Herbert had asked.
Karen closed her eyes and imagined what the kids were doing now. Saying the Pledge of Allegiance, then reading, or was it arithmetic? Do they eat before they go outside for recess? If we're all killed, who will pick them up at 3:20? She smelled the wood smoke from the shed and the cigarettes and the manure on the boots. She heard another pickup slowing for the drive and Herbert raising his voice to get everyone's attention. Then she looked to see if the station wagon was parked in and judged she could still get out if she drove across the lawn, under the clothesline. She could pack a bag, drive to town, collect the children, and get a job in Omaha, Des Moines, Minneapolis. They could live in the city where she could teach and coach, and the kids would learn to love theater and play soccer.
Resting her chin between her knees, she reached down with both hands to pick at the rubber on her tennis shoes. Pulling herself up by the iron railing, she turned to go inside and came out carrying her cup. She stopped to sip, walked down the steps and across the yard. "Morning, Karen," said the latest arrival. "Sam here?" "Hi, Mike, in the shed." She pointed with her cup. Followed the man down the pathway leading to the narrow opening in the doorway.
Karen stepped inside the dark barn carrying her cup, she the tallest person in the group, the only one with long hair. They looked at her as they would a newcomer into the bar or cafe, a dairy herd considering a Chevy, then looked back to Herb, standing aside the warm stove, holding a piece of paper as high as he could reach. Karen moved to the back of the crowded space. She leaned her back against the wheel of the anxious New Era combine. Trying to appear calm, she changed her position to stop her legs from quivering. She saw the men on the sofas, chairs, ringed around Herbert as they might at a real auction house, listening close, inspecting every syllable for error, questioning every motion and nuance.
The fire danced on the faces in the first circle. The wood smell was intoxicating at this distance. The warmth generated by so many bodies made one feel safe and right and almost willing. Karen finished her coffee, but continued to hold it at her chest with both hands. She could not help but think of Major Napoleon and Clover telling the others about the foibles of the folks in the house. Neither could she help wondering if this were the end of the world, if this is how very bad things begin. She could only hope these men were good, worthy of her trust and of her children's lives. Karen Tinker, the high school basketball star, watched it all in front of her in slow motion, not hearing a word that Herbert spoke. She allowed herself once again to try to communicate with Mrs. Weaver, who'd been killed while holding her child at Ruby Ridge, and with the mothers holding their babies at Waco, huddling against the gunfire and the smoke. Was it worth it? Who could tell her it was worth it? Who could tell her a farm, a portion of land with buildings and machinery, a house with the smell of coffee, was worth this? Why not just let it go? Oh, why not just wait for the rapture, let these money grabbers get what they deserve? Rapture? He mentioned it to Sam. He just smirked and said, well, more beer for us. Oh, but it could happen. It sure could. Just as sure as these men could bring back the one-room schoolhouse, it could. If anyone could leap from the church steeple to grab the town square clock and wrench it backward, these sons of Henry Wallace could. These grandsons of ornery farmers who looked upon the world as a fourth grader might peruse Sesame Street. He caught Ray's eye and just as quickly lost it. He saw the shadows of cats under the edges of the woodpile, heard the pigeons fluttering nervously in the upper corners of the building. The rain began to patter like dropped nails. Herb spoke louder now. Karen walked silently to the door, expecting a storm, but the metal always made it sound worse than it was. She knew that. She moved efficiently through the maze of pickups, checking for open windows. The rain stopped. She set her cup on the lawn, coiled her arms together, crunched her neck down like a hiding mother pheasant, walked toward the road. He turned right, turned left, and walked alone along the side in the brushy shoulder out of the mud.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO spooks walking down your front walk toward your front door are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week, same time, same place. I'd like to thank the various people that have helped us out along the way. WorldNewsTrust.org, TheSpiritualUN.org, and June2508.com. And thank you, Mike, and have a good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.